Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. We'll wrap up the week in this economy, of course. We'll check in on the progress of this recession. And how many people do you suppose you can safely fit in an elevator in a pandemic? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 19th of June, Juneteenth. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Not a whole lot of preamble today. I will skip the metaphorical throat clearing, and we will get right to it. What happened in this economy this week, and what does it mean? Catherine Rempel is with the Washington Post. Kate Davidson is at the Wall Street Journal. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Kate, let me start with you, and I want to go back to this past weekend, actually, when Rob Kaplan from the Dallas Fed and Mary Daly from the San Francisco Fed and Rafael Bostic from the Atlanta Fed all made public appearances and said, in essence, holy cow, Congress, we really need you to do something. I would just like to point out and get your take on the concerted action that the Fed seems to be taking.
Yes, this is certainly unusual. You know, the Fed generally tries to stay in its own lane that is focused on monetary policy and not fiscal policy, what Congress does, what lawmakers on Capitol Hill are doing. But in this instance, there's obviously a lot more sort of direct messaging coming from the Fed. And important to note that the regional reserve banks are a little more independent. They're not the board in Washington. Mm-hmm. But even at the board, we've heard Fed Chairman Jay Powell talking about the benefits that would come from Congress taking additional action to continue to shore up the economy. You know, there are a number of provisions that were included in legislation earlier this spring that are set to expire over the summer. And there are some pieces that economists have said were not really big enough, for example, aid to states and local governments. And so, right, you're hearing this chorus from monetary policymakers that, hey, you know, there's a lot more that could be done here. And I think part of the reason that they're talking about this is because the Fed has typically in the last crisis, and again, I think in this crisis, they're doing a lot of the work here. And I think that they want to see Congress step in and pick up a little bit of the remaining slack, or the slack that might be ahead.
Right. Well, speaking of that slack that's ahead, actually, Catherine Rempel, discuss for me how worried you are about the end of July and the extended unemployment benefits going away, with still tens of millions of people extra being out of work.
I think this is extremely concerning, right? We have higher unemployment today than we had at any point during the Great Recession. Beyond that, there are a number of other, fiscal levers that need to be activated at this point as well, mm-hmm. including that at the end of July, or rather at the end of June, a lot of states and localities will turn a new fiscal year. So there may be more layoffs coming as a result. So there are these sort of ticking time bombs that we're about to see, because existing benefits are being withdrawn. There might be more people flooding into the unemployment insurance system who need additional assistance. And unfortunately, even though lawmakers seem to be sort of on board with doing something more, they haven't figured out what that is, and they don't seem to be expressing a lot of urgency about either extending unemployment benefits or more aid to the states.
Speaking of ticking time bombs, and you two are just great with the segues today, Kate, I want to turn to trade, which, is back in the news, because Robert Lighthizer, the U.S. Trade Representative, went up to Capitol Hill this week, and said, we are absolutely not going to decouple from China. We need it in global trade. Could have done it 30 years ago, but we're not doing it today. Something like 2 hours later, his boss went on Twitter and said, oh, yes, we can decouple, and if I feel like it, I will. That's a paraphrase. My goodness.
Yeah, exactly, Kai. I mean, I don't have a good track record, I feel like, with trade questions when you throw them my way. I just sort of throw my hands up. I mean, I don't know what's going on. I think that, the president has shown when it comes to trade, his trade strategy, there isn't really a strategy. So I don't know what to expect. I mean, you saw, it's related but separate, the Treasury Department, Steve Mnuchin sent a letter to his European counterparts about sort of breaking off these talks on digital taxation talks, and is that going to cause a trade issue? I feel like a rational person would say, oh, there's not going to be any sort of trade shenanigans, for lack of a better word, over the next few months. We have enough going on. The government has enough to deal with coronavirus and with the economic deterioration. But I don't think that we can say that in the situation. So I really have no idea what could happen on that front before the election.
Catherine, you want to take a stab at trade?
Go for it, Catherine.
I think that it's the same problem, right? That logically you would think that this administration would not be erecting new trade barriers because, again, tariffs are just taxes, as we've discussed many times before. Do we really want to add more taxes at this point in the game, given where the economy is? But Trump never learned his lessons from the previous rounds of trade wars and trade battles. He still seems to think that tariffs are the answer to everything, that trade wars are the answer to everything, and has not yet learned that, in fact, they worsen economic conditions. Maybe in part because we had been blessed with, such a strong economy prior to the pandemic that whatever drag the trade wars were on the economy wasn't enough to offset all of the other good things we had going for us. But now we don't have those. You'd think that Trump would decide, okay, I'm going to lay off, but that's not been his MO so far.
One would think. Catherine Rempel at the Washington Post, Kate Davidson at the Wall Street Journal on a Friday afternoon. Thanks, you two. I appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street this Friday, two kind of blah days in a row. Actually, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Couple of stories now about the march of time and this pandemic economy. It's only been, give or take, like 3 months now, but it's entirely possible, likely even, that some of the lasting damage that Fed Chair Jay Powell talks about pretty much every time he talks is already happening, that we have hit a tipping point. Case study number one in our two-story series of stories, the pandemic unemployment problem. We have been telling you every Thursday since the end of March about the staggeringly and consistently high number of unemployment applications. Economists had been hoping, as parts of this economy start to reopen and some workers get called back, that the joblessness picture would get better. But as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, new layoffs are offsetting those gains, which means we might be getting closer to a permanent, persistent high unemployment situation.
James Gamboa is 46, a bartender by trade. He was furloughed back in March by the hotel where he worked in Miami.
I am still on a temporarily laid-off basis, but at least I'm still, I haven't been officially let go.
So Gamboa's in limbo, like about 15 million other Americans who consider their layoff temporary. Only what if not?
We're at a very perilous moment.
Bernie Baumol at the Economic Outlook Group says with the pandemic still raging, no vaccine, and consumers staying home, companies may reopen but have few customers.
If it turns out there is no justification for them to bring back workers, more of those employees that have been put on furlough may end up being permanently laid off.
The payment processor Kronos tracks how much people are working in real time. Kronos, by the way, is a marketplace underwriter. Kronos VP Dave Gilbertson says early in the pandemic, hours fell nearly 40%. That has turned around.
Half of the people that had been not working are now kind of working again. But we're still at historic lows in terms of the amount that we still have to claw back.
Meaning unemployment benefits, including $600 a week in federal pandemic benefits, will be crucial to keeping families afloat, says Jay Shambaugh at the Hamilton Project. And unless Congress extends them, those federal benefits will run out on July 31st.
And so if that expires, kind of the average person out there on unemployment, instead of getting $1,000 a week, would suddenly be getting $400.
Shamba estimates jobless benefits are putting more than $100 billion a month into unemployed workers' pockets right now. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
All right, so Mitchell had the labor market tipping point story. There is a corporate story to go along with that. Corporations that aren't going along anymore, I guess. JCPenney and Hertz and Gold's Gym, the oil driller Chisholm, they have all declared bankruptcy during this pandemic. 24-hour fitness, too, by the way, earlier this week. Fact is, you can't go too far without practically tripping over a bankruptcy these days. And despite all of the government's support and loans, it might just be too late for a lot of companies. Marketplace's Sabri Benishor has more on that.
2020 was expected to be a bad year for bankruptcies before coronavirus. They were up 14% in the first quarter, and they're now up 20% from this time last year. Jared Elias is professor of law at UC Hastings.
We are projecting a historic wave of bankruptcies over the next, 18 months or so.
How big of a wave is not totally clear. The pandemic has really messed with economic predictions. S. Abraham Ravid is professor of finance at the Cy Sim School of Business.
The market does not seem to predict a horrible year. Predicts a bad year, but not a horrible year.
For some sectors, it may well be horrible. Retail, travel, oil. For companies that were in trouble before the pandemic, it may be just too late for them. For others, it depends. Michael Sweet is a bankruptcy attorney at Fox Rothschild.
The question's going to be whether the government can continue to prop up businesses and people at a level that's meaningful long enough for the economy to get back on its feet.
The initial government relief packages were based on the assumption that businesses just needed a short bridge while things shut down for a month or two, says Carl Tannenbaum, chief economist at Northern Trust.
It now appears that the span of that bridge is going to need to be a lot longer, and the pillars in support of that bridge are going to need to be stronger.
In other words, he says we should not underestimate the economic impact of the pandemic. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishor for Marketplace.
Today is Juneteenth. Officially the 155th anniversary of the day enslaved people in Texas learned of their freedom after the end of the Civil War. More broadly, it's a celebration of that freedom. This is also the first year a lot of companies are giving people this day as a paid holiday. Target, Adobe, Nike, and Citigroup, to name just a couple. Decisions that were made in a hurry. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
The ice cream company Ben & Jerry started planning today's holiday about 10 days ago, says Chris Miller, head of global activism strategy. The company held a Zoom call with employees this morning to discuss Juneteenth and the company's response to the police killing of George Floyd. And then everyone got the rest of the day off.
At a time when we're not seeing each other, moments like these are important.
Miller says, yeah, meetings were missed, but the work can just pick up on Monday.
So I think a moment like this actually may have a real benefit to employees and the productivity of the company by providing just a brief pause for folks.
It can be challenging to quickly organize a day off, especially when the line between work and home has gotten so blurry. Employment lawyer Deborah Weinstein says many companies would see a hit to productivity or sales if they shut down for a day. She says that's why the people getting the day off are mostly white-collar workers.
They're not the service workers and the people who are at the checkout lines at the grocery store and the healthcare workers.
By giving employees a day off, companies are also inviting more accountability, says Nicholas Pierce, a professor at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management.
Now they are opening themselves to the question, next year this time, what have you done since Juneteenth 2020 to advance Black freedom besides giving people a day off?
Instead, Pierce says companies should make Juneteenth an intentional day on for discussing how to improve diversity and inclusion in the workplace. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And that's by putting mirrors in on the elevator lobby.
Yeah, fine. You look great, but back off a little bit, will you? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 208 points today, about 0.8%, 25,871. The NASDAQ basically flat, added 3 points, 99.46. S&P 500 subtracted 17, that's a 0.5%, 3,097. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow up 1%, the NASDAQ up 3.7%, the S&P 500 picked up 1.8%. Apple is reclosing 11 stores across 4 states where the coronavirus is spiking. Apple shares down 0.5% today. AMC Entertainment has done a 180 on masks after a public outcry. Movie chain now says it is going to require all moviegoers to put face coverings on, and it'll sell you a disposable mask for a buck if you forget to bring your own. Shares down 1.9% today. AAA says the average price for a gallon of gas, $2.11. A month ago, $1.88. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. As you might have heard, President Trump's going to Tulsa tomorrow for a re-election rally. Rising coronavirus infections and pleas from local officials not to, notwithstanding. The president's not going to say a lot about that, chances are, and city boosters probably aren't going to say much about this. Even before the pandemic shredded this economy, the Tulsa area had one of the highest eviction rates in the country. Nearly 8% of households there face eviction every single year, and that could easily rise because while a lot of places have stopped landlords from booting tenants during the pandemic, Tulsa is not one of those places. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that story.
Julie Sandridge had been renting the same house in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, just outside Tulsa, for 16 years.
It's just a four-bedroom brick house in a decent neighborhood. I've raised all my children there. I have 6 children.
And a one-year-old granddaughter she's raising.
And she's quite the handful.
Then in February, Sandridge got sick and missed several weeks of work. When she finally returned to her job in IT customer service at Blue Cross Blue Shield.
I went to work for 1 week and the pandemic hit and they shut us down.
By early April, she was 2 months behind on her $850 rent. Her landlords gave her till the end of the month to pay or be evicted. And Sandridge says she gets it. They have bills too. But
I'm the only breadwinner in the family, so it was pretty stressful on me to, you know, wonder where I'm going to go, what I'm going to do.
There are thousands of stories like this in and around Tulsa. Even before the pandemic, evictions were news.
More than 14,000 people are evicted in Tulsa each year. It's a staggering number that has the city ranked 11th highest in the nation.
That ranking came from the Eviction Lab at Princeton University.
We knew it was bad. We didn't know it was 11th in the country bad.
Jeff Janes is executive director of Restore Hope Ministries, a nonprofit rental assistance agency. He says rents are relatively low in Tulsa, but so are wages. And more than 15% of Tulsans don't have health insurance, one of the highest rates in the country.
Many of the people who we see that are facing eviction have a medical issue, a health issue.
On top of all that, Jane says the entire eviction process in Tulsa County favors landlords. It's relatively easy and cheap to file an eviction. Landlords don't have to show up at hearings, but still usually win. And there's money to be made.
I heard about a case this morning of somebody who's been filed on 20 times since 2016 by the exact same landlord.
Each time, the tenant managed to pay the rent, but the extra fees added up to almost $4,000.
What that tells me is that the landlord is not really interested in getting the tenant out of the apartment. What they're really interested in is collecting those fees.
In fact, out of the $325,000 Restore Hope paid landlords last year on behalf of tenants, almost 10% was for fines and fees. And though the courts don't track evictions by race,
we know that persons of color in Tulsa are experiencing higher rates of homelessness compared to their white counterparts in Tulsa, and we believe that that is directly related to the eviction crisis.
That's Becky Gligo. She was hired last year as Tulsa's first housing policy director to address the crisis. One strategy, resolve landlord-tenant disputes before they get to court using data and behavioral science. Water billing records show that tenants who fall behind are far more likely to face eviction. So the plan is to send those renters text messages about ways to get help. Carolina Toth is an advisor with the Behavioral Insights Team, a.k.a. the Nudge Unit.
the simple act of sending somebody a text message in language that is non-stigmatizing and encouraging can really increase the uptake of social services.
They're also trying to nudge landlords to use a free mediation program instead of the courts. They tested different email messages to see what worked. There was the straightforward how to do it approach, the peer pressuring everyone else is doing it approach, and finally, an appeal for empathy in this email. Landlords and tenants are both struggling to pay their bills. Here's what landlords can do. Toth says that one got the best response.
You're going through a hard time. They're going through a hard time. We're all struggling to pay our bills.
Whether that's enough to stave off an eviction notice, local charities aren't waiting to find out. Restore Hope Ministries covered most of Julie Sandridge's missed rent while she waits for help from the government.
So I'm kind of breathing a little easier right now and just kind of hoping that unemployment kicks in pretty soon.
A foundation has agreed to pay the rents for hundreds of tenants who had pending evictions before May 31st. But there's a catch. Landlords have to agree not to file another eviction for 3 months. Restore Hope says some landlords have already turned the offer down. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Spiking though coronavirus may be in some parts of this country, there are cities and states and counties that are opening up, and things are going to look different when people go back to their offices. Goodbye open floor plans and communal desks. Hello plexiglass dividers and face masks. Some buildings have put in thermal cameras or touchless entry doors. But there is only so much you can do to improve the safety of one of the basic features of modern office building life, the elevator. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Richard Corsi started worrying about COVID-19 pretty early. The dean of the College of Engineering at Portland State University is an expert on indoor air quality. So back in January, he stopped taking the elevator to his fifth floor office.
Well before the stay-at-home order, I was sort of taking the stairs down. For me, it was not worth the risk.
He says there are still a lot of things we don't know about how people become infected with COVID-19, but being crammed into a little box with no airflow can't be good.
And an elevator environment is oftentimes not an environment where you can stand pretty far away from people. And so you're likely, if they're looking at you and speaking to you, or if they cough, you're going to get this really high concentration of tiny droplets, even over a short time period.
That scenario carries the highest risk, he says, more so than pressing a button that someone else touched half an hour ago. It's most important to minimize exposure to other people in the car. That means passenger limits, masks, no talking, and facing away from each other, which could make for some awkward moments.
It's a little weird, I think. Everyone's kind of paranoid about, everyone at this point.
Technician Jordan Schroll started going back into work at a Pittsburgh IT firm at the beginning of June. His ride up to the eighth floor office used to be packed, but now only 4 people are allowed on each car, and there are footprint stickers in each corner indicating where to stand.
I've seen, some people kind of obviously uncomfortable, getting in or out of elevators, or if there's more than 3 people in them, no one kind of knows what's going on or what they should do.
So far, he says, people have been pretty good at self-regulating, but he can see how things could get ugly, with hurried workers battling it out for the last spot or hogging a car to themselves.
It's a Seinfeld episode, basically. We're living in one.
Michael Colacino is the president of New York City commercial real estate brokerage Square Foot, and he says even before COVID, good elevators were a big priority for his clients.
Standing there waiting for an elevator warps your, it's like Einstein. It's like the space-time continuum gets distorted. People are going to say, to hell with this. I'm not standing here for 60 seconds.
With COVID reducing capacity on elevators, many companies in high-rises will have to move to staggered schedules. Tech giant Salesforce has talked about giving workers tickets to ride elevators at specific times. And more buildings may look to install technology that groups riders by destination to make elevators more efficient. At about $50,000 per car, it's not cheap, though there is a low-tech alternative to make people feel better about waiting around.
And that's by putting mirrors in on the elevator lobby.
People can distract themselves, fussing with their hair or checking out how they look in their new mask. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, Johnson & Johnson says it's going to stop selling its skin whitening creams. Less popular here, more popular in parts of Asia and the Middle East, with names like Clean and Clear Fairness and Fine Fairness. The company says, and this is a quote, some product names or claims on our dark spot reducer products representing fairness or white as better than your own unique skin tone. That was never our intention. Healthy skin, they say, is beautiful skin. All right, we are done. Here, though, is your moment of economic context to end the week. We did mortgage rates yesterday, crazy low, right? Today, rent. The National Multifamily Housing Council says 89% of apartment households had made a full or partial rent payment by June the 13th. That's almost exactly the same as the percentage that it paid in the same period last year. It's up a couple of percentage points from a month ago when things were arguably worse in this economy. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.